Finance and Revenue. Good morning, committee. Good morning, everyone. We're going to do things a little bit out of order today. We're going to start off with a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 570 and 571 for purposes of looking at revenue impact. And then we'll move, that shouldn't take too long, but then we'll move into Senate Bill 64. And the informational meeting on school funding will be postponed until next week. So with that, Kyle is here, and I will open up a simultaneous public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 570 and 571. And you have a revenue worksheet that's been passed out.
Yes, Mr. Chair, good morning. If we want to start, yeah, 570. So in OLIS, under the meeting materials, see where this is. Down near the bottom of the meeting materials, it's about the fifth one from the bottom, it looks like there's SB 570-1 revenue examples.
Okay.
And so this would be these figures would kind of constitute the basis for any revenue impact made. And they come from this information comes from the Department of Revenue. They provided us with the underlying information for the fiscal year 2014-15. And this is inclusive of the historic cost less the depreciation. So a few meetings ago, we talked about just historic cost. And the department has done some work to kind of organize the information they have to include the less depreciation that is reported to them. So what the table is showing, what I did here is I wanted to just look. What the bill does is we have this historic cost less depreciation, HCLD, multiplied by this factor would kind of set a secondary cap that you would then apply, and the business would take the lesser of the two. So you'd have your standard current law way of unitary assessment, and then you'd have this other cap that you would calculate against, and then if there's some benefit to the business, they could take the lesser of the two.
Right.
So the factor we have right now in the bill is 130%, and that was in the original discussion. Thank you. In the original discussion of just historic cost. So as we added in less depreciation, that brought that number down. So I wanted to show just kind of a range of what this factor could be and what the ultimate revenue impact would be. So I have starting at 100% and going all the way to 200%. And the first column would be the revenue loss, and then I also included the revenue shift. And the difference there is in property tax, we have the loss figures come from the permanent or the operating levies, more or less. But bond levies, they operate on as a levy based rather than a rate based. So a rate is essentially calculated by you look at the total amount of property within the district and then the amount of the bond levies, the amount the district is going out for, and you calculate the rate that way. So if you exempt property, if you reduce the amount of value of property on the rolls, rather than being a loss, it's shifted to the other taxpayers within that taxing district. So we have the revenue loss, the revenue shift, and then the third column is the total saving to the business. So that'd be the sum of those two. So the business would see a reduction if we're talking just to use the 100% as an example here to walk through. The business would see a savings of about, or all businesses, I should say, not just a single one, of about $34.7 million. And the actual losses would be $29.7 million, and then $5 million would be shifted to the other taxpayers. And then I also included number of companies with tax reduction, just it's rounded a bit, but you can kind of see as you raise that factor, you're going to impact, there'll be fewer and fewer businesses that will be able to take advantage, or we'll see a lesser under this secondary calculation.
Okay.
And I know the original, some of the numbers we saw a few meetings back were in the $7, $8 million range for a single year, and that was part of the reason I ran it up to 200%, because that gets you closer to that same figure, about an $8.1 million loss at the 200% level.
All right, so to put this in perspective a little bit, Kyle, we've got 130% is the figure we've been working on, and that's 130%, that's the cap figure on intangibles as they relate to centrally assessed companies in this business. And the basis for that is the 2000, the current law, under which one of the largest taxpayers aren't even paying, and it's being litigated. So this is something that, while there's a revenue impact, it's for something that's not quite real. Do you have some numbers here for us that go back to the first year that problems started in 2009 and what the difference is there?
In some sense, yes, Mr. Chair. It's on the second page of this, so the next step is an example. We can skip through that. But on the second page, I have what is the deferred billing credits outstanding. So just real briefly to explain that, in response to what, I mean, basically the court case, the Comcast court case, is it's a rather large amount of tax that's at stake here. And a bill was passed a few sessions ago to allow this deferred billing credit. So we can take more or less the difference of this is what was being imposed on the company under local assessment. This is the new amount imposed under central assessment. And that difference there, the counties, rather than actually imposing that, receiving the money, and then potentially having to refund it if the court case is decided in favor of the taxpayer, they'd have to refund it with interest. So the idea was, well, let's just put it aside, or it's not even being collected. It's not even aside. It's just sitting out there. It's a bill that could be collected once the court decision is final. And that way it avoids, for both sides, no one has to pay with interest. So once the court case is decided, if it goes against the Department of Revenue, then this money doesn't have to be refunded with interest. And if it goes in favor of the Department of Revenue, then the taxpayer would owe it, but they wouldn't owe it with penalties and everything like that. So both sides are kind of held a little harmless there. But so this talks about kind of the difference between what's locally assessed and what would be centrally assessed. I don't have the figures for what would be locally assessed, and part of that is it's no longer locally assessed. It's now centrally assessed. So I spoke with a few of the counties, but we'd have to round up all 36 counties, and just haven't had time to do that.
Okay.
But talking to some of the larger ones, what they've been doing is they're taking what was their central or their locally assessed amount, and they're trending that forward, and then they're applying that against what the central assessment amount is, and that difference is what is this deferred billing credit amount. And so if we're looking at the 13-14 years, which is the most recent data we have with the deferred billing credits, I put the estimated tax under local assessment would probably be, for the total outstanding of $23.7 million in deferred billing credits, it'd be about $7.1 million is what we'd expect
as local
assessment. So that's what the bill would be under local assessment. Where under central assessment, it'd be the sum of those two figures. So we'd think about $30 million. So that's kind of the difference there. And it falls in line with about what we saw back in 2009.
And that would be a gain then for the counties?
Yeah, the gain would be the $24 million, the $23.6 million would be for the 1 year, would kind of be the amount if it's ruled in favor of the Department of Revenue. That would be the expectation of the gain.
Okay, so if under the current law, the legislature were to do nothing with this current, with the results of the Supreme Court case, there would be essentially a $17 million hit to the counties. What I'm asking is, if we make this change, what would be the change to the counties from, say, 2009, when these troubles first started and the litigation first started?
Mr. Chair, so you're asking if we made this change at like the 1.3 level, is that what I'm understanding?
Yes.
I couldn't speak to that today. We could take a look and try to recalculate that going forward, and then kind of show the difference there. But yeah, I'm afraid I don't have those numbers prepared today.
Senator Boquist?
Sure. To make sure I understand it, if we do nothing, the $17 million, does the $17 million even come into play on the front sheet? The front and the front is the $17 million loss if we do something at 1:30. If we do nothing, isn't it the deferred billing credits that are at risk? And if the case is won, then these $23 million in 13-14 would then be released and go out to the counties? Is that correct? And second follow up question, that in the deferred billing outstanding here, how many companies are we talking about? I mean, what comprises this deferred billing list here?
You don't need to name any companies, but is it one company or is there six or seven that are all waiting?
Yes, Senator Boquist, the answer to your first question was yes, this is kind of the outstanding. And the total we have, it's through 13-14, so there's another year out there as well that would put the figure probably around more like the $110 million range that would come in immediately, and then the 25 or so million each year after that.
This particular sheet is one company.
I was just trying to remember the second part. Yes, for the most part, I've spoken to some of the counties, and it's dwarfed definitely by one single county. There's a few others in there, but for most cases, it is just one, or we're talking 99% of this is a single company.
Okay. All right. And so this is really depending on what happens with the court suit, and we do nothing. Because it's under appeal, right, or whatever.
Remanded to tax court,
correct. And then back on the other side, so I understand here, the far right column, first deal, 100% factor, revenue loss is the direct revenue loss. Revenue shift is the shift in bond coming out of there. It's a bond. The bond's based on a percentage across there. So that's a revenue shift to whom?
To the other taxpayers?
Yes, Senator. It'd be to all the other taxpayers within that district for which the bond is being issued.
Okay. Total savings to business, I got that. And the number of companies on the right-hand side, the number of companies that are listed in here, do we know how many are public and how many are private so that we could therefore identify cleanly, according to legislative counsel, what percentage of this, like, for example, goes to cities, what percentage goes to school districts, so on and so forth like that?
Senator Boquist, I don't have which ones are public and private. I did have an earlier I didn't include it here, of a general kind of breakdown on percentages of which ones go to each district. Mm-hmm. Could dig that up. It would depend a little bit on where each one is locally located and what districts are there, but in general terms could provide it. It's going to fall with the way taxes are kind of levied and everything, of like the percentage that would go to schools or counties or
cities.
I could definitely dig up that chart. I should have attached it to this one here, but
all right, I'll follow up offline. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Kyle, what would be helpful to us here would be if you could do this chart and apply it and factor it to 2009-10. And I think what we're hearing and what counties and others are saying is the change that's being proposed here would be a significant increase in revenue to the counties from what they were receiving when they were locally assessing these same companies. And while it might be less than what would happen if we did nothing here, it would be significantly higher. And once we see those numbers, I think everybody will breathe a sigh of relief here. So that is what I hope you can provide for us, maybe tomorrow or on Monday.
Senator Bart Sugar.
No, I'm just thinking.
Mr. Chair, I did have one follow-up question. I apologize.
Yes, Senator.
Just to make sure, again, the deferred billing credits outstanding, just clear for the record. My understanding of this is this page here is good information for us, but it's a bunch of tax judges are going to decide what happens to this page.
That's right.
Because we can't go ex post facto backwards. So what we're only talking about here is going forward. So it'll be a judge who decides whether the $84 million goes wherever it goes, not us. Okay, thank you.
Okay. We are still refining amendments on 570 and 571, and probably today will be the last day we see these two bills as they are melded into Senate Bill 611. That we hope to see on Monday with the refined amendments. But for now, I do have Wendy Johnson signed up on 570 if you'd like to speak, and Gil Riddell, cities and counties, we're all here. And this is still a work in progress, so.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm the League of Oregon Cities. This is my first time before this committee in this role, having been at the Law Commission for the last 13 years. As you know, property tax is a complex area of law, and on my last three-week learning curve, I've learned it's incredibly complex. And so because of Measure 5 and 50, and then layer on top of that central assessment rules and the recent Comcast decision. So part of our concern is that this is moving really fast, and it's the numbers are high, and it's complex. Property tax is the city's highest source of revenue. For most cities, it's around 65% to 70% of their total revenue for their general fund. So anytime you take a cut on the property tax revenue stream, you're seriously impacting cities. Of those cities, in our last survey, about 64% of their general fund goes to public safety. So we're talking about cuts to public safety in most cities with any kind of revenue cut. We often think of residential property with Measure 5 and 50, but Measure 5 and 50 also affects business property. And so the Comcast case is going back to the tax court to deal with Measure 5 and 50 impacts on what the court held. But I want to make it clear that the cities did provide an amicus brief in the Comcast case and argue that Comcast should indeed be subject to central assessment. And the cities won on that argument. Comcast looks like a communication business, and the court held as much. And so the cities believe that Comcast should indeed be centrally assessed, and which that central assessment means they would be taxed on intangibles. So as Senator Boquist pointed out, that those numbers on the far left of what is in the deferred credit, that's what the cities and counties are owed right now under the law. And we understand that this committee wants to make some sort of an adjustment to that, but any of that would be a cut to present law. The League's position is that we understand the need for economic development, and we support that goal. We just want to make sure that we're balancing it properly with the cuts to revenue. So we're indeed bringing economic development to all of our cities and communities, as well as ensuring that that revenue stream is adequate and of assistance to the communities. Generally, any cut to revenue is something that the cities would like either the state to backfill with or allow it to be at an option. And with the way the bill is written right now, it's neither. So that's a concern. The data just, you know, literally came out just today, so we haven't looked at how much what that translates to the cities for how much of a revenue, but when we looked at the $20 billion in centrally assessed property, it looks like about $8 billion of that centrally assessed property is located within cities, and so that's $8 billion of assessed property that would be impacted across the state. We understand that the original goal of the committee and from the governor's office was to bring in more high-tech industry that had a large percentage of intangible property, and we support that goal. We're just concerned that the businesses that are impacted potentially with the Dash 1 amendments would include other types of businesses. In conversations with the Department of Revenue, it was my understanding that more businesses would be affected with the Dash 1 when you talk about less depreciation. And so seeing the charts today of only 70 to 20 businesses affected, that lowers the concern, but I'm still not confident, I guess, in which businesses would be affected with this alternative computation of figuring out what the tax would be. I think those are my comments, and I'd happy to take any questions, but I think our message is that we're concerned about the loss and just want to make sure that it's the right formula because it does have such an impact across the state.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Riddell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon County. Sorry about the cotton mouth. I didn't get a refill of water, but a couple of points. The deferred credit is something that Kyle did a very good job of explaining that. It was rather than waiting for an outcome of a case and having the money collected, the taxpayer pay the money, and then having to return it if the taxpayer wins the case. That's a shock to all budgets in the taxing area. So we concocted this idea that we give a credit, but the credit in effect is the taxes that would have been paid if the taxpayer lost. In this case, the taxpayer lost. The Supreme Court said that. The idea that we're waiting for an outcome is unclear to me. The outcome you may be talking about is going back to the to the tax court to determine the actual dollar amount, whether the maximum assessed value cap will rise, because this is new revenue that wasn't taxed, so it may well rise. In fact, I understand Department of Revenue is quite prepared, or the Department of Justice is quite prepared to defend that position, that, that this is new property, and so it will not be subject to the old maximum assessed value, but the maximum assessed value will be permitted to rise. So this money may well still be collectible under current law. I submitted written testimony. We are on both bills, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I wanted you to know, on the brighter side, that the commissioners and judges met on Monday. My written testimony was addressed to the in 570 to the first concept, which did not include depreciation, and the commissioners were warming to that. They understood it. It seemed clear. It addressed what the Department of Revenue wanted. The ambiguity removed. We're concerned that once you insert depreciation into a calculation, you're asking for litigation. We want the money to go to the communities and to the companies to use for their growth. We don't want the money to go into lawyers' pockets for litigation. And that's what this new and I understand it's moving along, but that's what this new method will encourage. Counties, Wendy said it well, but counties are very much in favor of community development. They are willing to give up immediate revenues for that purpose. But the committee, I hope, understands that growth in communities means growth in the need for public services. And we have counties that simply can't provide for the current public services. The idea of a tax break across the board for companies that are already here after the Supreme Court has decided that the Department of Revenue has done the right thing and is appropriately assessing these properties, I don't know quite how to explain that to my members. The concern for litigation, the lack of clarity that is inserted by the second method, it's just seen this chart, so have not absorbed it, so I have no direction on this specific this specific proposal, but we are looking for community spirited companies. We want the industries to grow, counties are very open to providing incentives. They've done it in the past. They'll continue to do so. But they also need to know that the loss isn't so deep that they cannot provide basic services for these growing communities. As to Senate Bill 571, we are fully behind through the Dash 1 amendments. We support it fully. So that one for us was nearly a no-brainer. You did moderate liberalization to current law. It makes perfect sense to us. You've stricken the requirement that it be in a tax abatement program. That still leaves the tax abatement program in the hands of the jurisdictions if they want to provide an added incentive to data centers. So we're just fine with that. This other, as you say, Mr. Chair, it's moving along, it's changing. So we were growing very comfortable with the first method that you had described, and at the 1.3 or 130% cap. This one, we'll wait and see how the numbers develop and so on. But I wanted to clarify a couple of things. So you give me that opportunity. I certainly appreciate it, yes. Chair. Thank you.
Thanks to both of you. Your concerns are noted. We're still refining amendments. Questions for the cities or the counties? Some of your members have been contacting us, urging us to move forward with this proposal promptly. So I know collectively you have some issues, and we're still working very hard to try and find the middle ground here. You know, frankly. The companies involved in this, the original hope was that we would just remove intangibles from that calculation, which would have been a huge revenue loss for the counties, and we are not doing that. And it feels like this cap is a middle ground that not only hits will require these companies or force them to pay more than what they were paying before this litigation started, but give them some more certainty that they would not have had otherwise. And importantly to me was it according to the department, should end the litigation that has been mounting up over the years. So that's the goal here, and we're all cognizant of the need to stabilize revenues in counties. We all know counties are broke, and we're trying to not make things worse. And in fact, I think if you look historically back a few years when this first started, that things will be much better in terms of revenues from where they were. And if we can get certainty and keep people out of court, that's all the better.
May I respond, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Removing intangible values is something that the Department of Revenue had addressed, that there was very difficult to isolate intangible values, that in other states that had tried to cut back on intangible values, they suffered from increase in lawsuits. We would, again, like to see it clear. We'd like the standard that DOR set out. It'd be clear and defensible and no ambiguity. If you include depreciation in the calculation, you are inserting the opportunity for lawyers to get involved in this and make some money. Setting the bar, the one end at no intangibles, which are difficult to define, versus halfway, kind of puts us in here. We'd like to have the other end be the law as it is right now, and then you provide incentives so that companies can grow that are here, and companies can move in with this knowledge of certainty, and then we have this as the other boundary. So that'd be my response, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no further testimony or business on 570 or 571, we'll close the public hearing and work session on those two bills, which may be the last we see of those two bills. I'll miss them. And I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 64.
You'll get over it. Here, Mr. Chair. Replace it with something twice as complicated. This is complicated.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It seems like this is the first time I'm up here with you.
And yeah.
It won't be the last.
Yes, well, you've been doing all the hard stuff. Now I bring you some fun and softballs. So.
We can use them.
Yeah.
Yes. So Senate Bill 64 is a concept that was introduced by the your committee through the interim. Thank you, sir. And now it's it comes, or it came to the committee and the request of Metro, and you have a number of signed up testimony as well as invited testimony, and the idea of Senate Bill 64 is to primarily allow for the clean up or change in language as it comes to the ability of the service district to have primarily on around the bonding and the payment for these bonds and how it works in that sense as it relates to the Convention Center Hotel. So there is probably a lot of legal language that you're going to hear and the discussion around it, but primarily the bonds and the payments for those bonds would come from taxes that are on the hotel motel tax, basically. So that's what you have today, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, let's start off with Tom Hughes. And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hughes. I'm the president of the Metro Council. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today on what I think should be a relatively simple bill, simple in that we are not asking you to change the law. We're simply asking you to take an artifact from the law out that has created confusion. And having been joined by our attorney, Allison Keene, I'm going to now take a swipe at attorneys and suggest that confusion to attorneys means opportunity. And so in this particular case, it has led to a couple of lawsuits, Hoya lawsuit and a challenge of a suit that we brought on the grounds that the statute did not give us the authority to issue the bonds, despite the fact that our charter does. And the statute envisioned the idea that once the charter was in place, the charter would supersede the statute. And so this clause that we're asking you to remove really has no validity anymore. And in fact, the courts have in both court cases, the courts recognized that was the case. And so,
Tom, can I get you what we're lacking up here is more of a perspective. Can you set the stage for us?
So what I was going to say, thank you, Mr. Chairman, is that this is the issue is raised because Metro is moving forward in conjunction with several partners, public and private, with the idea of providing a headquarters hotel for the convention center, which we own and operate in the city of Portland. This is a project that has been about 20 years in the making. Two or three different versions of it have been brought forward, and for one reason or another, not carried out. This one has gotten probably the most legs of any, I think in part because it has the novel effect of spending tax money that is not collected on anybody who lives in Portland or Multnomah County, but rather on visitors who visit the area. In fact, we're not asking for additional authority to collect more taxes. We're simply suggesting with our partners a different way of spending the tax money that we're already collecting. And so this particular project would allow us to build a hotel right across the street from the convention center. It would create, according to our travel experts, an opportunity to enhance the number of conventions that come to the Portland metropolitan area by somewhere between 5 and 12. That could raise as much as an additional $120 million of revenue for the region. And I do mean the region. This has a fair amount of support from the travel industry on the outskirts of Portland, as well as solid support from the travel industry within Portland. And you will hear in a few minutes from the head of Travel Portland, who will suggest that their organization has a great deal of support for this. It also creates a number of jobs, the obvious construction jobs that are well-paid but short-term, but it also creates in the long run 600 to 900 additional jobs in the hotel itself, and the additional $120 million worth of revenue in the region creates a number of job opportunities in the travel industry throughout the city of Portland. This project is moving forward relatively rapidly, and we believe that this particular change in the law will help that. But primarily, our concern is that we have now seen that this particular artifact, by creating confusion, has created a problem for this and future projects. And it certainly it clearly is not, was not the intent of the legislature when they passed the law to create those problems. It was not the intent of the voters who passed the charter that gives us the authority to move forward on this. And so with that, and I would be happy to answer questions about that, but I think it would be more appropriate to have Allison maybe explain a little bit of the details.
Okay. Allison, do you have some
Thank
analysis?
You. Thank you, Council President Hughes, Chair Haas, and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Allison Keene, and I am Metro's General Counsel. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I've provided written comments, which you have in front of you, and I'm going to summarize and supplement them a little bit. This bill makes it absolutely clear that Metro has the authority to participate financially in the Convention Center Hotel project under its charter, and that the statute does not limit that authority. Senate Bill 64 clarifies the existing language in the statute, ORS 268-310, which is at issue in the lawsuits about this project. That statute is set forth in Section 1 of the bill at lines 5 through 24. The bill separates the language that's been at issue in lines 16 through 20, as you can see. It separates that language from subsection 4 and puts it into its own new section down in subsection 3, lines 26 through 30, and lines 1 and 2 on the next page. And it adds a key phrase, quote, a metropolitan service district that does not have a charter. That's at line 26 through 27. By doing this, the statute is greatly clarified to match its existing legislative intent and multiple recent court filings. At your prior hearing, you were just hearing about how we want to make sure that we don't put in any language that might risk someone finding a little question to spark years of litigation. That's exactly what has happened here. And this change is made to not change the intent of the bill, but to clarify it. A little bit of historical background may be helpful to understanding what this bill does. In 1969, the legislature enacted ORS Chapter 268, governing metropolitan service districts. Although Metro is currently the only metropolitan service district in Oregon, Chapter 268 does contemplate the creation of other metropolitan service districts. And it provides statutory authority for those districts in the absence of charter authority. Indeed, before Metro had a charter in 1992, Metro operated under the authority of ORS Chapter 268. In 1990, the Oregon voters passed a constitutional amendment which allowed metropolitan service districts to adopt a home rule charter. And in 1992, the Portland Metropolitan Regional voters did that and adopted a home rule charter for Metro. In 1997, the Oregon legislature amended ORS 268, including this statute, to bring it into consistency with the Metro charter. A number of changes were made to make it clear that the laws governing metropolitan service districts in this chapter were in addition to any powers granted by district charter. For example, if you look at this bill, the 1997 legislature added the clause in line 6 that makes the whole statute, quote, subject to the provisions of a district charter. That was added in 97 after the Metro charter. Also in that year, the legislature added subsection 6, which you see at lines 23 through 24, which further authorizes, makes it clear that a metropolitan service district may exercise jurisdiction over other matters of metropolitan concern as authorized by a district charter. The Metro Charter enacted by the regional voters states that owning and operating the Oregon Convention Center is one of Metro's functions and authorities. And like many home rule charters, the Metro Charter does provide broad authority to carry out its stated functions, including issuing revenue bonds without voter approval. Indeed, the revenue bonds to be issued for the Oregon Convention Center Hotel project will be paid back not by Metro voters, not by taxpayers, but rather by the transient lodging taxes paid by hotel guests. This framework is explicitly authorized in the Metro Code. Now, this brings us to the need for the bill. This bill addresses the somewhat awkward word placement in the current statute at lines 16 through 20 of the bill. these are the words that have sparked 1,000 lawsuits. Well, really just two. But we hope this bill will hopefully end the prospect of 1,000 more. The inartful wording that you see there on lines 16 through 20 in brackets and the multiple subsections in lines 16 through 20 have been changed by this bill to remove that section or those multiple clauses and subsections and move them down to section 3 to their own section and added a key clause, which you can see in line 26 and 27, a metropolitan service district that does not have a charter. By doing this, by pulling out that awkward language, which modifies something that's already been modified, that's been modified above with variable subsections, and just putting it plainly in its own section, it clarifies the legislative intent and complies with home rule law that the statute's voter requirement applies only to metropolitan service districts without a charter. The passage of Senate Bill 64 will validate the pre-existing legislative intent, and it will confirm that Metro does indeed have full charter, statutory, and constitutional authority to issue the revenue bonds contemplated by the Oregon Convention Center Hotel Project. And we urge your passage of Senate Bill 64. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
We're open for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Keene. That was an excellent backgrounder. I have, with my background, I've always complained about the awkwardness in statute and legal writing, and you sort of validated my question, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to wrap my hands around this because, to be frankly, we have two sides of the business community and everybody fighting amongst themselves. So this is an interesting bill. You won a lawsuit. What prevents you from issuing bonds now?
That's,
in blunt terms,
that's an excellent question. We won a lawsuit. We won two lawsuits. We actually have won three lawsuits on this matter, on this case. They are all pending on appeal. And as anyone with experience with the Court of Appeals, they are underfunded, and it often takes several years to get a hearing. The opponents have objected to expeditious hearing on appeal. So although we are winning, we are losing by delay. And this clarifies and allows us, you cannot get, and frankly, it's very difficult to get a clean bond opinion, which is necessary before the issuance of bonds, while there are appeals pending. Even if, as our bond counsel says, they're close to frivolous, and what every court has said, they're still pending. And that makes them not as attractive to bond purchasers as something where there's no litigation pending.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
So in us layman terms, counsel or director there, what we're really saying is the judge hasn't issued an order or an injunction preventing going forward. The problem is getting a bond counsel to write a clean opinion.
Even if you get that for bond purchasers to say, okay, I'll just go ahead even though there's appeals pending.
Pull it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
And then that comes to the rate question, which I think I understand unless you want to add more to it. But my next question is, who's got skin in the game here? I mean, is Hyatt or Mortenson or somebody going to write a check, create a new LLC, and so they're really going to have new money in other than the percentage you're going to theoretically have at risk?
Project. First of all, I think one of the things that's more desirable about the structure of the deal this time than in previous times, particularly the last one where we were proposing that Metro float a GO bond and own the hotel outright and then hire somebody to manage it for us. In this particular case, our upfront money buys us things that the market would not drive, like the size of the hotel, the quality of the hotel, the existence of additional meeting space that we need to provide the headquarters hotel experience that would not necessarily be driven by the market. So the market would probably place a 200 or 300-bed hotel at that site without any kind of public participation at all. And that would not move the needle on our attractiveness to getting a hotel or getting additional conventions at all. So in order to get the hotel that we need to move that needle, we need to have some public participation. It's about a 200, I imagine it's at around $210 million hotel now. The public participation is about $80 million. And so Hyatt and Mortensen are bringing $120 million of new money to the table.
One final question, Mr. Chairman.
I clarify also that...
Thanks, always. That's why I bring my attorney with me.
$10 million comes from the state legislature, which has already issued bonds for this project in support of it. $4 million comes from Metro's grant. $4 million comes from the Portland Development Commission's grant, because the creation of this hotel has been their number one priority for this region for the last 20 years. And the $60 million that's included in President Hughes's number comes from those bonds that we're going to issue. But remember, that's not coming from public money being repaid. It's coming from the hotel taxes itself that will be generated. So it's the part that is public about that is that Metro is using its revenue bond authority to issue tax-exempt bonds, which can be issued cheaper. But the repayment will not come from the public. It will come from hotel guests' taxes on that hotel.
I happen to know a little bit of something about this, so I know not to be in this industry. because as you pointed out, it's going to pay for itself in theory. What's the forecasted occupancy rate?
Miller will come up in a few minutes.
Jeff Miller from Travel Portland, I think, has some of those details. And I think he can also address your initial comment, which was that the business community is divided. There are people within the travel industry that have chosen to oppose this project. The bulk of the travel industry is supportive, and the overwhelming majority of the business community in Portland is pretty supportive. And we have had testimony. This has already been taken before the Metro Council, the City of Portland Council, and the Multnomah County Commission for public hearings. And at those public hearings, we had positive testimony from a number of business people in the community representing small and large businesses. But Portland Business Alliance has been supportive. They raised some concerns early on. We met all of those concerns, and they have been supportive of this project. And I've got a partial list, which I will make available to the committee afterwards. We didn't make copies of it, but as I was looking over it, it is a partial list. But I think Mr. Miller can speak a little bit more directly to the travel industry specifically, and he has a board that is made up of travel industry. I serve on a board that is made up of the bulk of the travel industry, and in both of those boards, we've had overwhelming support for this particular project. So I don't know how much controversy there is amongst the business community.
And thank you for that. And really, this bill is not about whether this hotel should be built or not.
So, exactly. That question has been asked and answered on three occasions within the Portland and on three court cases. So, we're just talking about how soon can we do the bonds, and what is it going to cost the public to float those bonds, or how much money are they going to be able to put to the project?
Okay. Thank you both.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah.
John DiLorenzo.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner in the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I am here today on behalf of my client Aspen Investment Group to oppose Senate Bill 64. Aspen is among a group of downtown Portland hotel owners and managers who have for several years opposed Metro's plan to devote in excess of $78 million of taxpayer subsidies as a grant to Hyatt Hotels to build a 600-room hotel adjacent to the Oregon Convention Center. Paige Richardson and Michelle Rossolo, who are also associated with the group, have maintained litigation against Metro in an effort to further public votes for key components of the plan. I represent them in those cases. The first case, Rosselló versus Multnomah County, seeks to require Multnomah County to accept more than 20,000 signatures that Ms. Rosselló and Ms. Richardson collected from Multnomah County voters who insist on a referendum over the plan to finance bonds with lodging taxes collected from all hotels in the metro area. They amassed those 20,000 signatures. Multnomah County would not accept them. And that's what some of this litigation is about. The other two cases, the validation case in which Metro is the plaintiff, and Richardson versus Metro in Clackamas County, seek to require Metro to honor the requirements of ORS 268.310 sub 4, which is what this bill is about. That statute provides that, among other things, unless the electors, in other words, the voters, of the district first approve the financing of the facilities, the district shall not construct new facilities. That's what the statute says. Now, among the issues in these cases is whether the fact that Metro now has a charter trumps this statutory directive or not. My clients believe that the voters would never have knowingly given up their rights to approve risk-taking of these proportions and would demand a vote prior to Metro issuing in excess of $60 million in bonds as an outright gift to Hyatt to build this hotel. The cases are now in the Court of Appeals. Now, Senate Bill 64 is an effort to subvert the judicial process and to command a result. The result that Senate Bill 64 mandates is that these voter protections will only be available to metropolitan service districts that do not have a charter. That's what the bill says. However that may sound, it's important to recognize, though, that there is only one metropolitan service district in this state, and that is Metro. So let's not fool ourselves. This bill would deprive the voters of any opportunity to vote on financing for any new construction projects built by Metro, not just this hotel. The taxpayer subsidies for this hotel are very unpopular in the Tri-County region. In June of 2013, Paige Richardson released polling data that demonstrated that 79% of Multnomah County voters polled were opposed to transient lodging tax funds being paid to Hyatt. The poll also showed that almost three-quarters of all voters want to require a public vote before Metro can give tax money to build a convention center hotel. 73% were in favor, 23% were opposed. The poll, which was conducted by Lisa Grove, interviewed 400 voters and had a margin of error of plus or minus 4.9%. Now, we believe that the courts will ultimately hold that the voters of these district of this district have the right to vote on financial issues of this magnitude. Your approval of Senate Bill 64 will take away that right from the voters. Now, here are some of the reasons why voters might likely reject Metro's financing plan if allowed to vote. In 1998, Metro asked the voters for authorization to expand the Convention Center Hotel, saying that an expanded convention center would it allow it to compete for larger conventions. The voters overwhelmingly rejected that measure. Metro was later able to expand the convention center on its own using a car rental tax and transient lodging and tax revenue bonds. Despite Metro's expansion of the convention center, an increase in the number of visitors did not materialize. And by 2004, attendance at the convention center had dropped, declining below the pre-expansion numbers. In 2007, Metro designated the Oregon Convention Center Headquarters Hotel Project as a council project. Metro took the lead role to develop a 600-room, publicly owned hotel with a room block of 500 rooms. Then Multnomah County Commission Chair Ted Wheeler analyzed the project on behalf of the county and determined that the project was not economically feasible. In February of 2011, the Oregonian reported that Mayor Adams and Metro Council President Tom Hughes were interested in reviving the idea. On May 11, 2012, Metro staff issued a request for proposals for the development of the Convention Center Hotel. The request for proposals made clear that it was Metro's goal to minimize public subsidies associated with the hotel project. At the time, the total public subsidies for the project were to be $8 million. It was not until after Metro selected the development team led by Hyatt that Metro then agreed to contribute $60 million from the sale of revenue bonds. Now, Mr. Chair and members, had Metro included the $60 million taxpayer subsidy in its original request for proposals, there doubtless would have been many others willing to respond with more competitive proposals. The additional subsidy was demanded by Hyatt due to Metro's insistence on a room block agreement and also a labor peace agreement. Metro should have rebid the proposal based on these big changes, but it never did. Now, Metro stated that its necessary policy outcome was to secure a minimum room block commitment of 500 or more quality rooms and associated amenities. Ultimately, though, Hyatt only agreed to a 500 room block commitment if an event was scheduled more than 36 months in advance. If an event was scheduled between 24 and 36 months, the advance on the room block would only be 300 rooms. An event scheduled less than 2 years in advance were not entitled to any room block at all. In addition, Metro can only reserve 15 nights each month under the room block agreement. And Hyatt can charge 115% of its average group rates to Metro customers. This isn't a deal where they get a major discount. Hyatt can charge more than its average group rate, 115%. The room block agreement can be terminated altogether if Metro does not operate the convention center at a standard set by Denver, Vancouver, BC, Boston, and Seattle. In other words, if the convention center itself falls below those standards, Metro either has to spend more money to bring the convention center up to the standards of Denver, Vancouver, Boston, and Seattle, or the room block agreement goes away. Even this room block agreement is now a shadow of its former self. And even though Metro gave up much of what it wanted in the room block agreement, the $60 million grant to Hyatt still remained. And although never disclosed to the public until our litigation brought it to light, Metro's watered-down room block agreement could well disappear altogether if the hotel is not successful. Metro knew that for the room block agreement to be meaningful, it had to be superior to the mortgages on the property to protect the room block agreement from foreclosure. In May of 2014, Metro staff emailed Hyatt Corporation and said, quote, "Of great importance to the Metro counselors are the terms of the room block agreement. Do we have your agreement on a non-subordinate room block agreement, or do you have other solutions?" Hyatt replied, "We are not there, and to be frank, cannot find a path to your ask. We will agree to have the room block agreement run with the land, but the room block agreement will be subordinate to a property mortgage." In other words, junior to a property mortgage. Now, after a lot of negotiation on the topic, the senior development project manager for Metro informed Hyatt that, quote, "There are not four votes from our seven-member council to proceed if the room block agreement is subordinate to hotel financing. There were four shaky votes on proceeding if the room block agreement is subordinate during construction. Because the schedule we have is a bit of a house of cards with respect to items that need to be lined up, I need a decision from Hyatt that they are prepared to accept the non-subordinate position by noon tomorrow, or we will cancel hearings and declare an impasse." Several days later, all of a sudden, Metro's position softens. Metro writes to Hyatt, quote, "We are still working with one of our counselors who does not support the subordination issue and meeting with her again today. In the meantime, can you supply me some data on Hyatt's history of foreclosures? Three have been brought to our attention, and there may be more, Jackson, Chesapeake, and Cleveland." So he wanted to know about what about those foreclosures that have already taken place about Hyatt properties. On June 16, 2014, Metro gives up altogether and makes the room block agreement subordinate to the mortgage financing. So, not only is the room block agreement, for which Metro proposes to pay with interest almost $120 million over 30 years, not only is it ineffective, is going to be subordinate to the first mortgage. That means if there's a foreclosure, because the hotel is unsuccessful, the room block agreement will disappear. Now, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist asked about skin in the game, and that question is directly relevant to what are the potential of a foreclosure. You know, if the project didn't work well, would Hyatt be willing to let the project go? And the prior testimony suggests that Hyatt is putting a lot of money into this game. Well, let's do the math. Metro is granting Hyatt $4 million. The revenue bond gives Hyatt $60 million. The Portland Development Commission gives Hyatt $4 million. The state of Oregon gives Hyatt $10 million. That's $78 million. Now, Mr. Hughes just said that the total project cost is $212 million. That means that there's $134 million that needs to be raised. Well, all Hyatt has to do is go to an asset-based lender and get a mortgage for the whole $134 million. And why? It's because $134 million is only 63% then of the total project cost. And asset-based lenders routinely finance up to 70% loan to project value. If the project value is $212 million, Hyatt goes to a lender, gets 100% of that $134 as the first mortgage. The room block agreement is under that. The equity has been paid by the taxpayers. If everything goes to hell in a handbasket, Hyatt can walk away, let the project be foreclosed, and Hyatt will still have a management agreement that will survive foreclosure, but Metro will not, because the room block agreement will go away. So Metro has gone from being willing to pay about $8 million for an airtight room block agreement to now paying $64 million for a completely watered-down promise that can be lost to a foreclosure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Metro should renegotiate this agreement that was made in the worst of all markets 3 years ago. There are hotel owners and builders in this town, in Portland at least, willing to operate this project for well below the level of subsidies that have been offered by Metro. Mr. Chair and members, these are among the many reasons why our coalition has filed lawsuits to require a vote by the public. We believe that the courts will ultimately agree with our legal position, which is in the public interest. Please do not deprive the voters of their last chance to avoid what could be another government-subsidized albatross. Please do not proceed with Senate Bill 64. Let the judicial process run its course the way it is designed to function. I thank you for your time, and I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, sir. This bill, I appreciate what you just said and the arguments, and I know there are legitimate concerns and arguments on both sides of this. This bill doesn't ask us, though, to renegotiate the contract or get into the room block agreements or to second-guess Metro. This is a bill to clarify this section of law, ORS 268. And so in that regard, it's a relatively technical change designed for if and when this finally gets the green light and bonds are sold to allow Metro to have the most attractive package Metro can get under that scenario. Do you quibble with that? Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that observation, which I will treat as a question.
Yes.
Because I think you're absolutely correct. There are two issues, process and fairness, and then whether the project should be built and is wise altogether. The reason I addressed the project is twofold. Number one, Metro addressed the project during this testimony. And number two, I wanted to show you why the voters might be very unwilling to authorize these bonds if they were given the opportunity to talk about them. On the process side, the prior legislatures have not been willing to abrogate the rights of the voters to approve financing packages of these magnitude to Metro whenever it wants to construct new facilities. And so what you would be doing with Senate Bill 64 is extremely substantive. You would be eliminating the right of the voters to authorize financing packages for new construction. Now, it is true that Metro has prevailed in the circuit courts because they have convinced the circuit courts that because Metro has a charter, that the charter has now trumped that language in the statute. We believe the legislative history is clear that the subject to language means that Metro had the ability through a charter to limit its powers, but not to expand them beyond what the legislature had given them. In other words, to allow the voters to continue to have this right. It is very possible that the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court may view this differently than the circuit court did. And you know what? I heard Metro's legal counsel say these cases are close to frivolous. If they were close to frivolous, bond counsel would belly up to the bar and authorize the bonds. But bond counsel is unwilling to give them a bond opinion because bond counsel suspects that the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court may see this issue differently. And if they see the issue differently, the voters will have a right to vote. And if you authorize Senate Bill 64, you will be taking away that right from the voters. And so you are correct, Mr. Chair. This is process-oriented, but that process is very substantive.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. DiLorenzo? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Let's close out this with calling up Jeff Miller, and if John Mullis is still here, we'll bring you both up at the same time.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Jeff Miller, the president and CEO of Travel Portland, the Convention and Visitors Bureau for the city, and we do some work for the region. The basic package that a meeting planner looks for is a hotel adjacent to the convention center. That's just part of what they need. Those key delegates and exhibitors move back and forth between the hotel, the convention center, and use those rooms and hospitality suites. The delegates stay throughout the city and other hotels also. Portland's attracted a very nice amount of business over the past few years, but we've lost our fair share, too. Last year, we booked over 143,000 room nights associated with the Oregon Convention Center and over 260,000 total room nights connected to meetings with $158 million worth of economic impact to large and small businesses. But we lost over 64,000 rooms worth $43 million in economic impact because of the lack of a headquarters hotel, and this is from the meeting planners telling us this directly. We also lost 146,000 room nights because of, with economic impact of $110 million because of the hotel package. We tend to have smaller hotels, and so when we are pitching for a piece of business, say 1,700 rooms on peak, we're telling the meeting planner they need to book into 5 to 8 hotels. Other cities are saying 2 to 3. I will tell you that the room block agreement as it stands works very well for us at Travel Portland, and we are the sales agent for the convention center. Those big meetings book 3, 4, 5, 6 years out. We're booking into 2021 and 22 right now, so I'm not concerned about that room block agreement. And 115% of the rate also gives other hotels the confidence that their rates won't be driven down by this hotel. So that is actually a good thing for us and for other hotels. In 2014, December ended, the Central City of Portland had an occupancy rate in our hotels of 80.2%, an all-time high, $160 average room rate. And if you think about that over the small and large hotels, that's very significant and a high for us. And a revenue increase of 15.3% in hotel revenue. That's the fourth straight year in a row. With this robust economy, we are getting smaller and smaller room blocks from the existing hotels, so it is harder for us to attract business, and this hotel then gives us the opportunity to really increase our economic impact. Now's the time for the city of Portland to be able to absorb these additional rooms very easily with this robust economy. We also know that the convention business is a driver of regional and statewide tourism. Tom Drumheller from Escape Lodging out on Cannon Beach and Jeff Constam at Timberline have both shared with me they know when a big convention's in town. They see those people. They know they're staying in their properties. Those delegates that come for a meeting come early and they stay late. We also know that the meeting may be the first time that these folks have come to Oregon, and once we get them here, we own them. They love our state and they love to see everything going on. Our job at Travel Portland is to make sure that we do our job of pushing people out into the state. We hold meeting planner events at the resort at the mountain, Timberline. We go out into the wine country, to Red Ridge Farms, to Ponzi Vineyards, and many other places. We take that charge very, very seriously to be statewide ambassadors. The Board of Travel Portland is composed of 11 hoteliers, 3 elected officials, 14 hospitality partners, and they have overwhelmingly supported this project twice. Those hoteliers, many of the hoteliers on our board, know that this hotel will drive more business to the city and grow the pie for everyone, and not just that hotel. So they're very, very supportive. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Mullis.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Mullis. I represent the Oregon State Building Trades Council, which is an umbrella organization for about 25,000 union construction workers. Our industry went from being fully employed and, in fact, probably shorthanded in 2007 to 6 months into 2008 being unemployed at rates of 35% to 60%, dependent on the craft and the part of the state. And the Portland area and region has recovered better than the rest of the state, but we still have a lot of members in the Portland area and all over the state that are unemployed or underemployed. So we support this project not only for the jobs that it will create for our members, but for the related jobs it will create for architects and engineers and material suppliers. And I'll agree with Mr. Miller and the other speakers about the economic development that it will create not only for Portland, but for the entire state. Another great opportunity that this project would provide is apprentices, opportunities for our apprentices to learn their crafts. Our apprenticeship is our system of higher education. They spend 3 to 5 years normally learning their craft. 90% of that learning is on-the-job training. Only about 10% of it is in the classroom. And all of our programs are ramping up and trying to get more apprentices into the system to meet the increased demand that's out there. Having said that, they have to have jobs to go work on to be able to complete their craft and journey out. Another hat that I wear is I'm one of 5 members of the Portland Development Commissioner, one of the 5 volunteer commissioners, and I didn't come here today to speak on behalf of the agency, but having said that, you've heard earlier that the PDC has put a lot of time into this project. We will invest money in it once it breaks ground, and we believe it's key to economic development, again, not just for the area, but for the entire state. And I'll close with a real-life example. We have very close relationships, in fact, partnerships with our signatory contractors and their associations, one of which is SMACNA, which is the Union Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning National Contractors Association. A couple years ago, they looked very closely at Portland for their national convention and at the end decided not to come because there isn't a hotel right next to the convention center. This was a group that would have brought 4,000 people to town. Obviously, 4,000 people aren't going to fit in a 600-room hotel, so all the other hotels in town are going to benefit from their visit as well. These are successful union contractors from all over the country that have money in their pocket, that a lot of them are going to stay in the area. They're going to rent a car. They're going to drive out to the gorge. They're going to go to the coast. They're going to go to the wine country. They're going to go to Crater Lake and spend money. So I would urge your support for this bill. I thank you for the opportunity to share a few words, and I'll do my best to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you both. I have read reports about how large conventions do benefit the downtown Portland Hotel simply because of the case you just mentioned. I'm not sure if that's a point that sticks with the opposition or not, but for those. Any questions for these two gentlemen, Senator Wright?
Thank you very much. About how many construction jobs will be on this project?
Chair Haas, Senator Riley, that's a fact that I should have brought to the meeting with me, and unfortunately I did not. My guess is that somebody from Metro here could answer that question, but if there isn't somebody here that can, I will find the answer out and I will get it back to all of you.
Yeah, if you do that, please.
Okay.
Further questions? No. Thank you both.
Thanks.
No one else has signed up to testify on Senate Bill 64, so I will close the public hearing. And we have no other business before us, and we will pick up on Monday and continue our work on central assessment with the hopes of passing a bill out next week. We are adjourned.
I've got a question for you.
We are adjourned.
got a question for you.